traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
By the way, you can also get the premium service on Substack, contrarianpod.substack.com. Exact same benefits, exact same price. This particular episode is brought to you by the Connecticut Economic Literacy Initiative. Do you know a young person aged 8 through 15 interested in learning about the stock market? What about learning how to budget and make money in ways that schools don't teach? How about why countries are rich or poor? What about the economy? What if you could learn all of this while also competing for cash prizes? 2 high school students have launched the Connecticut Economic Literacy Initiative in order to explore these concepts and many more. This program is not exclusive to Connecticut. It is entirely virtual, open to anybody aged 8 through 15 who has a high-speed internet connection and can join on Zoom. It's 100% free and 100% virtual, consisting of activities like groups of buyers and sellers, trade simulations, budgeting, and stock picking activities with cash prizes for winners, and much more. So visit the CELI on Facebook or Twitter at CT Econ Literacy for more information. I am here with Gad Levenon. He is the head of the Labor Market Institute at the Conference Board in Princeton, New Jersey. Very excited to have him on. We are going to talk about wage growth, employment, the economy, and what this means potentially for the economic cycle and for Fed interest rate policies. And Gad here has some pretty contrarian views where wages are concerned. Specifically, that wage pressure due to low unemployment rates are likely to begin earlier this cycle than in other expansions and take hold much more quickly. As we record this, the unemployment rate is around 5.5% in the US. So we're not all that far from what is considered full employment. But let me kick it over to Gad and tell us his views on this and to get us up to date on it.
Thank you for having me, Nathaniel. Much appreciated.
Thanks for coming on.
The main point where I probably differ from a lot of forecasters is the concern about long-term labor shortages. So we are now in a period where we have the most severe labor shortages in recent memory, but those are probably partly temporary. We have a kind of a lot of factors that are disrupting the supply of labor, like high unemployment benefits and the fear of getting infected and childcare issues. But hopefully those obstacles are going to go away in a few months. And then we'll probably see less severe labor shortages. But I think the main point is that because of unusual demographic and educational trends, I'm expecting labor shortages, especially in blue collar and manual services jobs, to be the kind of the new normal until the next recession. And that would mean that those types of jobs will see fast wage growth for the foreseeable future. Maybe let me talk a little about why I think this. So I think it's well known that the working age population in the US is barely growing. In fact, in 2020, it declined for the first time in US history. And it's expected to barely grow for the rest of the decade. So I think a lot of people know that. But what is less known is that this overall story masks two opposite trends by education. So if you look at the number of people in the working age with a BA, that number is growing continuously at about 2% a year, even more. And this is what we expect to see in the coming decade as well. But the number of people in the working age population without a BA, that number is shrinking. Already in the past 5 years or so, it's been shrinking, and it will continue to shrink. And the reason is that over time, more and more people are graduating from college, and the new people entering the labor force are much more educated than the people who are exiting the labor force because of their retirement. So the number of people with a BA is continuing to grow, and the number of people without a BA is shrinking. Now, why is it important for the labor market is that people with a BA are rarely going to work in blue-collar and manual services jobs. You rarely see a truck driver with a BA or a plumber or a cook. Those jobs...
Did you see waiters?
But anyway, you do see waiters, yeah. You do see some. It's not zero, but you see... For the most part, people with a BA aspire to different types of careers. That means that the people who are willing to work in those blue-collar and manual services jobs, their number is shrinking. And that if this number is shrinking faster than the number of jobs needed in those categories, then that will create a continuous shortage, which was already the case before the pandemic. In 2018, 2019, we had the blue-collar labor shortages and much faster wage growth in those types of jobs than kind of in the professional managerial class. So I think that is likely to continue to be the case for the rest of the decade.
Hmm. Yeah, that's on the one hand kind of disconcerting because it is going to, of course, drive up the cost of these services like plumbing and electrical work and anything else, construction, right?
Yeah.
So that's going to make, which is going to make things more difficult, one would think, for economic expansion in certain ways. On the good news is that you don't have to go to college then to earn a living wage. You can learn a trade. Of course, this may not be good news for upwardly mobile families, but that is the reality. But anyway, that aside, talk to me a little bit about some of the other effects of this that you're anticipating this labor shortage.
So I think kind of in the context of wages, what we've seen already in recent years and will I think continue to see is let me back up a little. Throughout most of the recent decades, wages of highly educated people grew faster, sometimes much faster than for people without a BA. But that changed around 2015, 2016, and since then you see the opposite trend. People without a BA in types of jobs like blue-collar manual services earning, seeing a faster wage growth than the more educated professional type. So I think that will continue. I think... overall wages will rise faster, and I think that has several implications. One for corporate profits, you know, other things equal, when labor cost goes up, profits go down, unless they pass the cost to the consumer, which is another option that this will end up in a higher inflation. I think because of what I said earlier, that the impact of this will vary by industry. So industries that have a lot of blue-collar and manual services workers will see a bigger impact than industries that mostly hire white-collar, consulting, finance, tech. Although tech is a separate thing because tech, because of the huge growth in the tech sector, there are they have their own recruiting problems there. Yes, so I think those companies, those industries are going to see a higher impact, a bigger squeeze on corporate profits and perhaps a bigger increase in consumer prices.
That thing brings to mind places like Amazon, if you think about it. But anyway, not to mention any specific companies.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
There is maybe one trend that could help this is automation. And, a lot of machines taking over a lot of the more manual tasks. I mean, we mentioned truck driving. Self-driving cars are still a ways away, but eventually, everyone, if we're talking 10 years, that could happen. But then other advances in technology could make some of these more labor-intensive jobs obsolete, right? What do you think about that?
So I know that's definitely an option that could happen. I would say the decade before the pandemic was very disappointing in this regard. We had in the 10 years before the pandemic, we had the slowest labor productivity growth, which is related to automation. We had the lowest labor productivity growth probably in U.S. history. Had a lot of the low-hanging fruit of replacing workers with technology apparently took place before that. So, for example, in manufacturing, in the past decade, there was almost no growth in labor productivity in manufacturing. Now, so I think one has to be skeptical about the ability to have massive amounts of automation. But I think there is a chance that it would happen. I think that the fact that we have such a severe labor shortage now is incentivizing employers to look for other ways to produce with fewer workers. I think also perhaps the shift to online activity in many sectors, and including work, could also eliminate some jobs that are no longer needed. So I think productivity and automation is a wild card. If there is a major improvement there, then I think the problem of labor shortages will be smaller. But if we kind of continue as we did in the past decade, then I think it's going to be a very severe problem. I would say that there are other U.S. companies are very, very resourceful. And one thing that they did before the pandemic that we probably see again is that they tapped populations that before were less connected to the labor market. So in the 2-3 years before the pandemic, we saw a large increase in the participation rate, the labor force participation rates of, for example, Hispanic women. They're probably the group that has the least, the smallest participation rate, and they've seen a very big jump in that before the pandemic. Also, the Black population became more connected to the labor market. So that's one thing that could help. And another is immigration. It's a very complex topic, and one could have opinions pro and con, but from the perspective of labor shortages, I think it's obviously more immigrants is going to reduce the problem.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And last word on automation. Anybody who's ever owned a Roomba device will know that there's not really very much to be afraid of there, because those things really don't work very well. And they supposedly have all this AI built in, and they just kind of drive around on the floor and kick up dust and don't do anything. So we have that kind of going for blue collar workers, I guess. Cleaning houses, by the way, cleaning is one of those things that I don't see how you'll ever be able to replace it. But anyway, All right, moving on here. How close are we to reaching full employment? Like I mentioned at the outset, we're 5.5% now. Things are clearly trending in the right direction. They were pre-COVID as well. And you think we'll get there sooner than most?
Yeah, I mean, I think when in late 2020, when the vaccines were discovered, they were discovered quicker than expected, and they were much more effective than anyone anticipated, I think. So that changed the outlook significantly. In previous, after previous recessions, it took probably 4 to 7 years from the beginning of the recession until we got back to what's called the natural rate of unemployment, which is now estimated around 4.5%. I think we are probably going to be in this territory probably less than a year from now. We have a very strong growth. We are already at 5.4%. So I think we'll get there like around the middle of 2022, which is about 2 years after the beginning of the recession. And so we will get there much faster than usual. If history is any guide, like once an unemployment rate starts declining, it usually keeps declining until the next recession. Moderately, like it's not declining as fast as in the beginning, but it continues. Like you look at every economic expansion, the unemployment rate is almost continuously declining. So we probably, and the next recession could be 5-10 years from now. The expansions are getting longer. We know how to manage business cycle better. We're still not perfect, but central banks are getting better at this. So we could be, you know, have 5-10 years ahead of us with declining unemployment rates, which will gradually continue to tighten the labor market further and further.
Hmm. Very interesting. And a lot of these trends and these things that you speak of are not solved with monetary devices, right? Like the Fed can raise rates or lower rates as much as they want. If there's no workers, if the supply and demand imbalance with workers is such, you're still going to be paying a lot, right? You know, so what does that say for the next stage once they do start tightening?
Well, you know, the Fed, they have their own tool of interest rates, and the way they can, the way they will fight it is essentially to slow the economy through the interest of the, you know, housing sector first, and other interest rate sensitive industries will suffer a lot, and that will gradually slow down the economy. But I think what that means is that kind of this labor shortage, because of the Fed commitment to prevent inflation, the labor shortages will determine, or the growth in the labor force is the thing that is going to determine the pace of economic growth in the next decade, and could be a real constraint.
Yeah. Interesting. And again, that's not anything that they'll be able to do around monetary policy with that. I mean, so yeah.
They will not solve the problem, the specific problem. They'll just kind of use their big hammer to simply slow down the economy. They can't do anything, I think, to specifically solve the problem of lack of shortages. That's, I think, more the governments can do, by, for example, raising immigration.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Very good. All right, God, Levanon, I want to take a short break, give our sponsors a chance to make themselves heard, and come back and ask you some more questions. If you are a premium subscriber, don't touch the dial. You will not get the break. To become a premium subscriber, you can go to the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up, or contrarian.supercast.tech, T-E-C-H. We'll be right back.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server.
They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
The Connecticut Economic Literacy Initiative is not exclusive to Connecticut. Any person ages 8 through 15 is welcome to join the programs on Zoom. It's 100% free, 100% virtual, consisting of activities such as groups of buyers and sellers, trade simulations, budgeting, and stock picking activities with a prize for the winner, and much more. Visit the CELI on Facebook or Twitter at CT Econ Literacy for more information. All right, welcome back, everybody. Guy Levinon here. He is head of labor markets, the Labor Markets Institute at the Conference Board. Guy, this is the section of the podcast, of the episode, where we talk to our guests a little more about their background, their professional background, how they came to their station in life. So curious about what path you took.
Well, as you can tell by my accent, I wasn't born in the U.S. I'm Israeli. I was born and raised in Israel, and I did my undergrad and master's in Tel Aviv University in Israel, and I also worked in the Israeli Central Bank for a couple of years. Then everyone told me that if I wanted to do a PhD, I should come to the U.S., so I came and did my PhD in economics here, met my wife, so decided to stay in the U.S. my first and only job since then has been at the conference board. Maybe I should tell the listeners a little about the conference. Yeah. The conference board is a membership organization, a think tank. So our members are many of the largest companies in the world, and we provide research for them, insights for what's ahead, and also convene them in various ways. So I've been there in the economics department, and you know, over time, we realized that the topic of labor markets is very important because it's the two largest research areas at the conference board are economics and human capital, and labor market sits right in between. So there is a lot of interest from many businesses, but many business professionals, but I would say especially from the HR community, that are, of course, interested in everything related to workforce and labor. So that's what I've been doing, and I'm now the head of the Labor Market Institute at the conference board.
Very interesting. You know, this all begs the question with all this human capital and labor costs and stuff. What do you make of the whole remote work trend, and what are you seeing there, and how do you think that could impact things?
Yeah, I think this is the biggest legacy of the COVID-19 in the context of the economy and the labor markets. This is a huge shift. So if, let's say, before the pandemic, maybe 7% of office-related jobs were done remotely, this in the post-pandemic could easily be 30% or even more. 30% or more primarily working from home. So this is a dramatic shift in a very short time. You know, usually such big trends take decades to happen, and this is happening in 2 years. So this will have a major impact. One is you can now hire anywhere, or many companies are willing to hire anywhere. And we're already seeing this trend. You know, we are tracking online job ads across the country, and we already see that, for example, tech companies in Silicon Valley are shifting a lot of their job ads towards locations outside of Silicon Valley. So this will create a lot of those trends. I think another important trend is what's called the donut effect. So businesses that operated in city centers, like next to the big office buildings, are suffering much more because fewer people are coming to the office. And also some people are moving away from city centers because they can get cheaper housing in further away places. So this kind of the emptying of the middle and the shift to the outskirts of the metro area and even beyond. So that is another big trend. So it will have a lot of implications beyond how we work, but also like larger economic effects beyond that.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big one. I wonder, you're based in Princeton, New Jersey, right?
No, actually, I'm in New York City.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, then that's how have you seen things process in New York? I mean, have a lot of people left? Or are there a lot of companies that have relocated?
Well, some people left, but I think the biggest impact is all those people who used to come every day to,
right,
you know, downtown and midtown Manhattan for work are now not coming. I heard the story of that, like there was this hot dog truck that used to sell 450 hot dogs before the pandemic every day, and at some point during the pandemic, he was selling 10. So this has been a catastrophe for businesses, especially food services around the kind of the city center in New York.
And do you see people or companies coming back? Have a lot of your clients there talked about that much at all, or is it really just going one direction?
Well, I think the initial trend is to of people than companies is to move out. But you know, those buildings are there; they are not going to disappear. So, I think what's happening is that as companies are getting out of their leases, they would rent a smaller space because they don't need as much space, and that would lower eventually. Already starting to and will continue to lower office rents, office prices, and of course in retail there is also a similar trend. So what could happen is that the prices of real estate, of commercial real estate in city centers will drop, and that will actually incentivize companies that couldn't afford the price in Midtown Manhattan before to move in. So you know, I think those buildings are here to stay. They're definitely going to build fewer in the future, but the amount of office space in New York is pretty inelastic, and someone will eventually come in there. So, but I think the impact will be in the prices of real estate. Yeah.
Interesting. And as far as other impacts or other, what kind of other trends are you picking up? I imagine that's the big one. Yeah, is there anything else?
I mean, one very interesting trend that is also related to kind of social issues is, for example, racial wage gaps before the pandemic kept on increasing, even though many companies are trying to improve the situation. It just kept increasing, partly because the rise of tech in the western part of the country where there are fewer black people there, and so they were not part of the kind of the big increase in that industry. So, you know, I hope that the events of 2020 are going to reverse that trend a little, and we will see racial wage gaps shrinking. And I know that this is one of the main trends in companies is to try to increase the participation of people of color in high-paying jobs. So that I don't know the answer to that, but this is something we're planning to work on and see if indeed there was a turning point around 2020 in that context.
I wonder also if companies that are hiring now nationally, there's probably still issues, hurdles to hiring internationally. But if you hire nationally, if you're located in Silicon Valley or in New York City and you're paying a certain amount for a job, and now you're going to hire somebody in Duluth or in wherever, you can get away with paying a lot less. Are you seeing trends going in that direction?
So we do see, as I said before, Silicon Valley companies are hiring more outside. And I suspect that lowering labor cost is partly the motivation for that. It could be that also their motivation is to increase diversity in their companies, because you can't find many black software developers in San Jose, but there are many in Washington, D.C., and Atlanta, and Charlotte. So that may be another motivation.
Mm. Very interesting. And as far as any other effects of having people living more rurally, potentially more suburban, have you thought about that at all, the effects of that?
Well, the prices around, for example, around New York City in the suburbs and even areas like 1-2 hours away from the city are having the time of their lives. So I think... And you know, it may create like a virtuous cycle that, you know, professionals from New York City will move to some of the rural areas and make them more attractive to other professionals. And we will see like a really big transformation of some of those rural communities. I think that could be happening as well. Yeah.
Any particular rural or communities that you might have seen benefit yet, other than Miami, Florida, which we all know about?
Well, I know that the Hudson Valley
is seeing
a lot, and some parts in Connecticut that are closer to New York, but even 2 hours away from New York City on the Hudson Valley, I think they are seeing some benefits.
I mean, I'm in Connecticut, and I left New York City last year during COVID, and with the intent of buying a place up here, and I'm up in New Haven about 2 hours north, and the price has caught up, and the supply of houses has gone down, and it's been a very tough market, so I haven't bought it. But so I can absolutely speak to that. I like to ask people, especially economists, is what is it that you're most concerned about that has you kind of up at night, and if anything?
Well, I think like everyone is concerned about the polarization in the US. And I think as an economist and as a labor economist, I think a lot of it is driven by growing regional inequality, that I think a lot of the benefits of in the last decade or two, especially from the boom in tech, is concentrated in a few locations, and the rest of the country is left behind. And I think I don't know how this trend would stop, because it's not, I mean, those kind of areas are becoming more and more attractive, and the places that are left behind are becoming less attractive for young educated people. So it's kind of a trend that I'm not sure could easily be stopped, and I think that's a big contributor to the polarization that we see in the country overall. So that's okay. For example, the Midwest. You know, if you look at the states that are like next to the Great Lakes, 50, 70 years ago, they were among the richest in the country, and now they are on average among the poorest. Not the poorest, but getting there. So those trends are concerning me, partly because I don't know what could stop them.
Remote work, right? I mean, wouldn't that be one thing? Like if you can live cheaply in Detroit or wherever, and
so if that happens, I that could help. But the question are people who can choose to live anywhere, wouldn't they choose some like a vacation destination in an attractive area, or like maybe college town where there's a lot of like activity, social, cultural. I don't know how many will choose to go to like old manufacturing towns that are in a decline. But I think remote work may move the needle a little.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast. Maybe in closing, you can tell our listeners how they can find out more about you and your research, and I'll put that in the show notes as well, if there's any URLs or anything like that.
I don't remember the URL, but they can Google my name, and there is a bio page. I'm also an op-ed contributor at Forbes, so they can find some of my pieces there.
Nice. All right. I'll put those links up.
Okay.
Wonderful. God, Lebanon, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Thank you all for being with us, for listening, and we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you, Nathaniel. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.